KaiserNetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation Barbara Jordan Conference Center for this forum discussion on the implementation of the Medicare drug benefit. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Foundation, and we're really pleased to have you all here this morning for what is not a usual Kaiser briefing where we release a new survey or provide a new set of analyses. This one is a briefing intended to really let us share with some of the people who are implementing the new drug benefit, as well as those on the ground trying to connect beneficiaries to their coverage, what some of the issues have been in the first month as this new benefit is launched. We see and have data, thanks to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that we can look at in terms of how many people have credible drug coverage, how many of those individuals are being covered under the standalone plans versus under retiree and advantage plans. And today, they're reporting 23.7 million with credible coverage. That's about 55% of all Medicare beneficiaries. But I think it's worth noting that 5.6 million of those are the dual eligibles whose coverage was transitioned from Medicaid to Medicare, and we'll hear more about some of the issues facing that population. Another 5 million were already enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans, many of which had their drug coverage through those plans prior to January, and 9.5 million came from both retirees in the federal government and in the private sector, leaving about 3.5 million to have joined the standalone plans that have been much the focus of the reporting and the discussion in recent days. That leaves about 45% of the Medicare population out there to be future enrollees in these plans. And so today's discussion is really going to focus on how the program has moved so far and where it's moving in the future. I'm really delighted that we have an incredible range of perspectives to share with you this morning. We are delighted to have Leslie Norwalk, the Deputy Administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, with us. And obviously, Leslie has been dealing daily and probably 24 hours a day with the implementation issues around this plan. We're going to turn from our discussion of how the plan is being implemented to ask Karen Ignani, President and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans, to talk about the plan's perspective on the implementation, and to Barbara Edwards, who's the former director of the Ohio Medicaid program, to put some of the issues for the dual eligible population in perspective. We've also been fortunate to have Debbie Garza from the director at the Walgreen Company of their pharmaceutical programs to be with us, as well as Barbara Cannelli, President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and Vicki Gottlich, the Senior Policy Attorney with the Center for Medicare Advocacy. Each of these individuals is able to give us a different perspective and different insights into how we're faring so far in month one of the new Medicare drug benefit. But I'd like to kick off our panel by turning first to Leslie and asking her to give us some of her perspectives on what's worked, what hasn't worked, and where you're going in the future.
Thanks, Diane. So we have some good news and some bad news. Good news is, as I mentioned, we have 24 million or so Medicare beneficiaries with creditable coverage. That's critically important, and we look forward to having more and more of them sign up every day. One statistic I find particularly interesting is over 1.5 million of the 3.5 or so that you mentioned, Diane, actually have signed up over the internet. In spite of the concerns we heard that people don't use it, apparently many do, or at least in some way, shape, or form, perhaps our partners in the ships, for example, may use the internet to sign people up. That's terrific. Over 1 million scripts a day are being filled, so many Medicare beneficiaries are, in fact, getting the drugs they need. We hear stories on a regular basis how they're saving, in some instances, thousands of dollars and are very relieved to have the coverage that they've so desperately needed for a long time. So that's the good news. The bad news is that there are some glitches in the system, and in particular, I think you can categorize them in a couple different ways. The first is that Medicare beneficiaries who are dual eligible, who were automatically enrolled Most of them are getting the coverage that they need, but there are many that were switched at some point in time from the plan in which we automatically enrolled them in the late fall, sort of November or so of last year. They switched plans, as is their right to do, to a plan that may better suit their needs or from a formulary perspective. But in that switch, while they may have been enrolled in the correct plan at the end of the day, the new plan may not have had the information that they needed to have in order to correctly determine their limited income subsidy amount, which is to say what their copayment would be. And so many have showed up at a pharmacy and the pharmacist has asked them to pay $250 in a deductible and so forth, which can certainly, if you're dual eligible, give you great pause. And it concerns us that if any one individual is being asked to pay more than they should. So we're spending lots of time internally working with all of our partners, and I think almost everyone at the table qualifies, because we'd like to hear specifics from everyone, from the advocacy groups, the beneficiaries themselves, the pharmacies, the plans, and so forth, so that we can diagnose whatever the particular issue may be and solve it so that beneficiaries get the drugs they need. If one beneficiary can't get the drugs they need, that's certainly one too many. So I can assure you that all of us are spending morning, noon, and night, all day, all week long to solve this problem, and won't stop until we do. The second issue is beneficiaries getting their card or at least a letter with their member number on it. Currently, how it's structured is that beneficiaries who sign up, for example, on January 31st have coverage on February 1st. Certainly, it would be difficult for them to get their card overnight, and is not what happens actually anywhere. So from an expectation perspective, we just need to be sure that beneficiaries understand that the later they sign up in the month, the more difficult it may be when they first show up at the pharmacy, and that we found that transactions go much more smoothly. In fact, we haven't seen very many issues when someone comes in with their drug card to the pharmacy, and so we're hopeful that that in fairly short order, as those are distributed more widely, that these issues will become less and less. But we certainly appreciate each and every individual and all the varying constituencies who have helped us diagnose what these issues are and solve these problems so that beneficiaries can get the drugs that they need and that we can fill far more than a million scripts a day. So thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. And I know, Karen, that you've been experiencing some glitches as well as, I hope, some successes along the way. So why don't you share with us some of the implementation issues you've been facing.
Thank you, Diane. I'm also very pleased to join this distinguished panel and look forward to the discussion. I'd like to begin with basically two points. One, I think that it's become axiomatic, but it's worth underlining the point that you made earlier, Diane, in your introduction. I think if we had looked back 2 years ago, no one would have expected that toward the end of the first month of this program, that 55% of beneficiaries would be in the program. So I think that that's, first of all, a major accomplishment. It's a credit to CMS and the states and a range of individuals that have worked hard to make that possible. Second, and we know a number of those individuals, by the way, did not have prescription drug coverage beforehand, and a number of them now are getting subsidies that they never had. So that's a positive. Second, in the market, I think no one would have expected the pricing that's in the market in terms of premiums, in terms of deductibles, in terms of coverage in the gap, in the donut, whatever term you are most comfortable using. So I think our plans have exceeded expectations. So those are the positive I see, enduring positives from a perspective of a beneficiary and advocacy groups who are quite rightly concerned about that those populations that have been historically underserved. In terms of the challenges, there are threefold as we see them. First, I want to applaud CMS for issuing on Friday the 13th some additional guidance with respect to the transition. We have, maybe quite surprisingly for some, we welcome that guidance. Everyone is aware that there are systems challenges. We are working, I want to assure everybody, 24/7 with CMS, that's also working 24/7 to bring in the best private sector experts to get the systems issues resolved. in issuing the guidance to give us some specific directions about what to do in terms of walkarounds or bridges until these systems issues can be addressed, it allowed our plans to very specifically target their efforts to deal with the challenges of the dually eligible, to make sure they don't leave the pharmacy without a prescription, and also to smooth out the transition for people who had heretofore not had coverage. That's the 30-day transition, prior auth, et cetera. So working very, very hard, CMS did something very important. Also, I want to make sure, Diane, that I make it very clear from our plans perspective, we intend to make states whole. We appreciate the fact that states have tried to have intervened, have tried to help, again, smooth the way for the dually eligible and for the low-income population. We intend to reimburse the buy-down on the copay, and we will reimburse for our contractual amounts in terms of the prescription drugs. And we've been trying to send that message very loud and clear. Going forward, we are going to continue to work together with CMS. We think that more ground can be covered in terms of the systems issues. And again, I want to applaud CMS for the time and attention they're putting on this issue. And together with our plans, I'm convinced that the data transition issues will be resolved in the very near future, which I know will be a very helpful thing from a pharmacy perspective, from an advocacy perspective, et cetera. So we are pleased to be at this point now with so many people in the program, to be at this point now, to have the opportunity to clearly communicate our commitment to making sure these beneficiaries are very appropriately and effectively served. So you'll be hearing a lot of that from our plans, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Karen, from the perspective of the plans, we see that a lot of the enrollment has been concentrated in a few plans, and wonder whether that has some implications for, do you think there'll be as many choices and as many plans down the road, or is this part of the shakeout here?
Well, I think that's a very good question. We hear from all of our plans, so I think we have a very good on-the-ground view. The press has covered some of the larger plans and the enrollment, and that's certainly very good news to track that. On the other hand, we're also hearing daily from our regional plans and our local plans, and there's very good news on that front as well. And I think that that's a positive. Well, so I'm convinced that beneficiaries will have a spectrum of choices, whether they have exactly the same numbers in the future as they do now. I think everyone expects that over time, there maybe in particularly in the on the prescription drug only side, there may be some shaking out. There may be some entities there that are now finding that they didn't have experience with government contracting. All of our health plans that have been on that side had experience in government contracting and will continue to be there and have joined this program on both sides with the intention of being there for the long haul. In addition, we have some wonderfully innovative programs for the frail elderly, some of the demonstration authority that CMS has allowed, doing very innovative things on disease management, which I think also provide a lot of core capacity, not only on the Medicare Advantage side, but also in the future for the fee-for-service side. So I think we can contribute more there.
And Barbara, obviously the frail elderly have been an issue with regard to the Medicaid programs. And as we've heard, many of the glitches occurred among the dual population. Can you sort of give us some perspectives from your post until November as the head of Ohio's Medicaid program?
I had the opportunity to be involved with the National Association of State Medicaid Directors in some of the advising around how this program might work with regard to the duals. And I know that, unfortunately, much of what happened with the dual population was predictable and was predicted. And despite a great deal of effort by CMS, because I want to be clear, I think states recognize that CMS worked very hard on these issues, that any kind of a massive movement of 6 million people on one day that happened to be a Sunday and a holiday weekend was not a good idea.
Holiday for some.
Well, it was a holiday for physicians, and that's part of the problem. So this was not a good plan from the day it started to move all of those people on one day. And in fact, the state's number one recommendation was that it ought to be phased in for the duals. And in fact, I guess I would just like to say, and then I will get off that, is that I was figuring this out. States have in combination about 2,000 years of experience in running health plans. And during that 2,000 years, we have probably made every mistake that is possible to make. And our best advice was this kind of a significant change, because this was a population of very frail people, very dependent on medication, who already had coverage, to be transitioned into a new plan is best done in a planned, phased-in methodology where you can work out the inevitable data problems on, and get them working before you move the bulk of the people in. So having said that, recognize CMS didn't believe that was an option. I think that states have done a yeoman's job at trying to step in to fill in the holes when it became obvious they weren't going to be able to get fixed fast enough in that initial system turn on. There's still a lot of confusion among the consumers, but clearly everybody's working very hard to try to retrofit some of these issues. I think that what I would like to stress is that states generally feel relieved, I believe, that CMS has said will make you whole. I think if you look at the process that's being proposed to do that, it's enormously complex and it's going to be a ton of work behind the scenes to try to get those reconciliations to work, because none of these data systems were set up to do this kind of retrospective matching. What states are paying to the pharmacists where they've had to step in is not what the plans have negotiated. So there's going to be a lot of unmatched payments to claims and very difficult record keeping that's got to be reconciled. So that is just yet another challenge in the future. But I think it's absolutely the right step that CMS has said. We recognize states need to be made whole and to recognize there are administrative costs involved in that. So I think that's a good thing. What I'd like to stress as well, though, from a state perspective and from a consumer perspective is that for the duals, there is still a challenge ahead, and that is actually finishing a successful transition into new formularies. The transition period was supposed to provide people with a period of sort of safety in there where they could get their old prescription filled if there was a difference between the old formulary and the new formulary, and then work through the process of either successfully transitioning to that new medicine or getting an exception made in the process. That process is just beginning for a lot of folks and is largely untested. So again, I think there still are some really important system challenges ahead, and consumers are going to continue to need some support as they move through that, because physicians continue to not be real clear on this. Pharmacists are still going to have those challenges. Plans themselves, as we have learned, may or may not all understand the process equally. And whether the systems will support it accurately is still a good question. So there are still some challenges out there. And it is very clear that everybody's working very hard on this, and that's good. I hope we learn some bigger lessons from it as well, that we don't repeat what is not necessary about a process being this difficult.
And Vicki, what are you learning on the ground from the consumers you're dealing with?
Well, in addition to the consumers that I generally hear from and the advocates I generally hear from, this week I had the opportunity to do three web-based trainings for members of the Access to Benefits Coalition. And these are really the on-the-ground folks. These are the SHIPs. These are the social service agencies who are working with actual individuals. And what I can say is that they are still very, very frustrated. In fact, somebody on our call yesterday was in tears because she was just so tired, and I had explained the exceptions process, and she just kind of threw her hands up, even though she was in Oregon and I couldn't see her. But you can hear it in her voice. We applaud, like everybody else, the heroic efforts that CMS has been undertaking to get this program started. And everybody on the calls and everyone that we've spoken to applauds those efforts. But yet we still hear from people who say, I've been working with my regional office and I've been working with my health plan, and they told me that this person would be able to go to the pharmacy and get her drugs, and guess what? She went to the pharmacy and it still wasn't in the system, and she still couldn't get her drugs. And one person said on a call on Tuesday that she called back the person in the regional office at CMS, and that person was stymied as well because he had done everything that he could. The plan had done everything that the plan could, and they couldn't figure out why the system wasn't working. So hours between CMS, the plan, the advocates were spent, and yet this one person was not able to get her drugs. And we are concerned that the system is really complicated and there are systemic problems that will be ongoing. I was really glad that Leslie raised the issue about what happens to people who enroll on January 31st, because we are starting to get those questions. We are hearing from advocates across the country that about 60% of the duals they see are in plans that don't cover all of their drugs. And so I'm starting to get questions from people who say to me, if my client changes to a different drug plan on January 26th, will they be able to get drug coverage under their new plan on February 1st? And we don't know what the answer to that will be. I mean, clearly that individual is going to have drug coverage because the individual's been automatically enrolled in a plan, but will they be covered under the new plan that covers all of their drugs? We don't know. The other problem that that question raises is something that Barbara touched on, and that's the whole issue of exceptions. During the transition, as Barbara said, you were supposed to either change your drug or apply for an exception. And yet these advocates who I speak with routinely have not thought about applying for exceptions rather than changing plans for their clients. And the exceptions process, if it works, could actually work much faster, and they may be able to get an answer within 72 hours or 24 hours or even a shorter period of time, and so they don't need to clog the system. But it seems to me that the information about exceptions not getting forward to beneficiaries and their advocates. Part of the problem is systemic, and that is most of the information is going to be included in the evidence of coverage. People haven't gotten their evidence of coverage yet, and in fact, CMS recently extended the date in which people can get their evidence of coverage. And we know when we change health plans, you don't get your evidence of coverage on the same day. There are notice issues as well. The system as designed places the burden on the beneficiary or on the doctor, and we're hearing that this can be very problematic. I spent yesterday trying to find prior authorization forms on websites for certain plans. I couldn't find them. One of our paralegals actually called a plan who dug very, very deep and found the site so that she could send it back to me, so now I have the web link for those prior authorizations. That's a pretty difficult process for people as well. Another problem that we're hearing is still a problem with the copayments, and there isn't information about copayments. Some advocates said that they heard cries of help actually from a plan that said, we still don't have the information telling us whether somebody's paying 1 and 3 or 2 and 5. And everybody was sharing the same pain and the same frustration. And then the other issue that we're starting to hear is the issue of people who newly become dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. And what we're starting to hear are problems for people who became eligible for Medicare in the month of January. These people lost their Medicaid drug coverage, but they have not been automatically enrolled in a plan yet. So some of these folks, because they're not in the computer systems, have no drug coverage at this time. So there is a lapse in time for which these people may or may not have any drug coverage. WellPoint point of service option should be able to assist these people if they can show that they have Medicare and Medicaid. But again, this is an issue that needs to be addressed. And then the final issue that I want to raise for beneficiaries is the issue of reimbursement. In the first few weeks of this month, there were beneficiaries who are eligible for the low-income subsidy or duals who ended up paying $250 deductibles, paying full freight for drugs, paying for higher copayments than they should be required to pay. And these individuals could really use reimbursement. They could use a simple system for reimbursement. I mean, clearly, under the rules of the plan, if you paid for your drug, you can submit your receipt to the drug plan. People aren't aware of how that works. A lot of these people don't have receipts. It means they're going to have to go back to the pharmacy, who's already beleaguered, to try and get copies of their receipts. So we're hoping that CMS and the plans could come up with a system that would reimburse people easily to make them whole.
And from the perspective of the pharmacy, Debbie, why don't you share with us what you're seeing at the counter?
Well, I think everyone has some snapshot of what's happening at the pharmacy counter, having either experienced it or seen it on the news or read it in the paper. And as you know, the pharmacy is definitely where the rubber hits the road in this program. there have been glitches, and when you multiply those glitches by the sheer volume of people coming into this program and the sheer size of the program, coupled with it starting the first of the year when we have typical employer group plans that change anyway, that tends to get amplified and magnified from that perspective. From a pharmacist's perspective, we definitely want people to get their medications. It's in our best interest. It's what we do. We as healthcare providers have the utmost concerns for patients, and we try to do everything we possibly can to take care of them and make sure they do not walk away without getting their needed medication. And pharmacists have stepped up to the plate to handle a lot of these administrative burdens that were more prevalent early on and that have since been worked out, as Leslie and others have addressed. There have been some fixes that have occurred, and there will be continued fixes, so we will continue to see improvements along the way. But I guess to look at what we have experienced thus far, I would step back and kind of put it in three broad categories, and one being from the eligibility perspective, one from the copay perspective, and one from the covered drug perspective. And to understand what happened and what happens at a pharmacy counter, you kind of need to understand the world in which pharmacists operate. We operate online, real-time processing of prescription claims. We count on information we get back from plans to know how to help patients, what to charge patients, et cetera. And a lot of that, when you're really talking about our dependence on insurance cards to identify the eligibility of patients in their programs, and when you're looking at the masses of folks who don't have these cards, it becomes problematic. And CMS has done a great job setting up their system. It's a super concept, their troop facilitator. It's fantastic. When it works, it's a beautiful thing. But you have to have the information in the system to back up the technology. And that's where CMS has been very responsive and is now working with others outside groups as well as the plans to get the information to the system so that we can more real-time provide eligibility information for the patients, know what to do, know how to process the patient's prescriptions. Then when you talk about, and excuse me, let me step back, and when you talk about the eligibility concern, that's where you run into having to make calls to the plans and experiencing the long hold times with the plans because of, again, the sheer volume and how many calls that are being made. And everyone has stepped up to address that with regards to plans adding more folks at their help desk, as well as CMS adding more people so that we really can get information and do our best to take care of these people at point of sale. And then when you talk about copays, that has been one of our largest challenges, particularly with regards to the low-income subsidy people and those that should be paying $2 and $5 and the $1 and $3. Many times people have the letters from the plans that state what their copay should be, but when they then walk into the pharmacy and we go to process that prescription, in our world, again, everything done electronically, we process the prescription, we expect to get a message back that adjudicates what the patient should pay. And many times the correct information is not in the system with regards to accurate copays, et cetera. And that's where, as pharmacists doing what we do, have tried to make phone calls to plans to find out what is the correct copay such that we can have it overridden at the time the patient is standing in front of us, or we've decided to give patients a few days supply of medication until they can come back and we can get it worked out, or we've gone ahead and decided to give it to them at that copay, and then we'll deal with getting it back from the plans at a later date. And then lastly, when you talk about the covered drugs, there is a challenge, of course, as we all know, there are particular drugs that Medicare Part D does not cover, which are some very common drugs used in the senior population. Your anxiety medications or some medications for seizures and such. So in that scenario, what could help is to have more consistent standard messaging from plans whenever we get a message back that says drug not covered. Is it really drug not covered? Is it because the drug's not on formulary? And that's, you know, pharmacists kind of, again, what they get back with the message from plans, know what steps to take next. And so if we see a drug not covered, we will then know most states have stepped in to pick up some of these medications and we'll then know to bill that state. Or if we get not on formulary, we then know to call the physician, call the plan, or to find out what the plan is doing for the transitional part for that, 14-day of coverage or whatnot. So I think that there have been some great steps made in terms of really kind of now talking about these things, getting out and making everyone aware of what happened, of all the partners involved here. And our pharmacists have learned from January 1 to now what types of steps and processes to take. So I would definitely have to kind of say, you know, bottom line, we have a vested interest in this work. It's important for us to take care of these patients. We want to capture the senior business, capture these folks that maybe have gone off to Canada or have just never gotten their prescriptions because they could not afford to. So bottom line, it's a great program. We're here to do what we can to make it work, to serve our customers, and we're just excited that we do have partners such as the advocates who are willing to, you know, all come to the table, work together so that we can take care of the people who are staring at us, standing in front of us at the pharmacy counters each day, and really the pharmacist in the trenches are the true unsung heroes on the back end trying to burden a lot of this, and they're doing a great job, you know, taking care of the patients that we've taken care of thus far.
Thank you. And Debbie, do you feel like the pharmacists are overburdened by their need to match people with the plans? And also, is that taking away from some of the counseling they might be doing about alternative generic drugs to some of what's being covered in some of the other patient education that has been increasingly a role we've asked pharmacists to play?
Well, as a pharmacist, I could not sit in front of you with a straight face and not say that pharmacists have not been overburdened by this. Yes, as I said, just with the sheer volume and it all coming and coming at a time when we already have changes, it has been burdensome. There's been a lot of confusion amongst seniors, and we've been very active in communities, as have many other community pharmacy groups, as well as advocacy groups and governmental agencies. Everyone trying to educate people to help with that educational process, but we all know it's the pharmacist that most people turn to for information and for questions, and so it has taken us away from some of the other time we would spend with many of our other customers. By the same token, I think that many of our other customers have parents and grandparents and seniors, so there tends to be an understanding that this is a great, you know, new program out there, and there are going to be these transitional issues we've got to get past. And so for the most part, it's worked well, and folks have understood. Our patients have been rather patient and allowed us to spend the extra time with them.
I think the point is that most of the people on this panel haven't been doing much sleeping for the last few months. But Barbara Cannelli, perhaps you could share with us from the consumer's perspective some of the challenges and some of the successes here.
Just come off the White House conference as a policy member and being a chair of the Leadership Council on Aging Organizations, I've been hearing an awful lot. But I'm speaking now as president of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. It's a large organization, 4.6 million members and supporters across the country. And all we really do is address Medicare and Social Security and the preservation of these programs. And this couldn't be a perfect time, Diane, because we just did our annual survey and we had our focus groups, and we could have saved a lot of money because what we heard and what we paid for is exactly what the national polls are showing. Our members feel that the program is complicated, it's expensive, and it often doesn't meet their needs. And I have to be honest with you, many of our members are a little above the older senior income level, and many of them do have coverage under their former job. Diane asked me to give examples of what our members are saying to us, and we have 10 people on the phone all day, and our members are retired, so obviously they have a lot of time to call. And I could keep you here all day telling you what we're hearing, and they're very sad stories. We know, I mean, we've got the member that went to the pharmacy 5 days in a row, and it was for seizure drugs, and eventually she did have a seizure and ended up in the hospital. And I could go on and on, and I'm not going to, because we all know that it was very difficult the last couple of weeks. And yesterday we had a ship person come into the office because many of our members in the area, in the Washington area, want to learn more about it so they can help their friends and neighbors get what they have to get. And the ship person, I have to tell you, was absolutely wonderful and absolutely exhausted. She has been working a night and day. we know that these problems are going to be addressed. And I want to add my voice to CMS, that they have been doing a huge job in hiring new people to help with this situation. And you know, some of the problems should not have been unforeseen. They should not have. I mean, nobody knew how many people would sign up, but we all knew there were 6.2 million duals. And the fact of the matter that they weren't prepared for that, I really find that was a disgrace, because if you're a dual, you are. You're the most needy, and they shouldn't have had to go through what they had to go through. But there will be bills, and there already are bills. Senator Rockefeller has introduced a very broad bill to address some of these situations. There will be bills to maybe put the penalty off. Obviously, our president has already said that the federal government will reimburse the states. And what I want to say, and I know these are healthcare people in this audience, what I want to say is this implementation debacle is just the top of the iceberg, just the top of the iceberg. These horror stories are going to fade away. The mechanism will be in place. And what I don't want to see happen is the proponents of this legislation. I don't want to see them pat themselves on the back and say, well, everything is okay, because this simply is not the case. There are fundamental problems behind this legislation, and these problems are not going to go away. Some of them aren't so, you know, dramatic. Seniors don't know yet, and our seniors really don't know yet, that the companies can change their formularies repeatedly, and they can only do it once a year. But what I really worry about is there is absolutely no cost containment in this bill. And maybe a donut hole, it's almost become a cliche, and maybe it looks benign. But if you're on a fixed income and that donut hole is going to become wider, it's going to hurt seniors. There's no doubt about it. But the problem is, down the line, this is really the privatization of Medicare. And what I worry about are not hiccups in implementing a new program. These are fundamental flaws in the bill's design, and they are not going to go away. And when I think about it, I think, you know, we're going to hear a lot about health care. Particularly next week in the State of the Union message. We are constantly hearing that our entitlements are costing much too much money. And yet, when the Congress and the President had opportunity to create a new benefit, they were happy to give the money, the subsidies, the billions of dollars to private companies rather than create a simpler and more cost-effective program within Medicare. I had the opportunity a couple of days ago to go out and talk with Bob Ball for a couple of hours, because I'm fascinated with the whole history of the entitlements. And I said to Bob, what happened in 1965? What happened in 1965 when Medicare came into being? Was there this confusion? Because I've heard some people say, any big program, there'll be massive confusion. There was no confusion, because they had the Social Security records. And the only question when someone was going to go into Medicare was, do you want to go in, yes, or you don't want to go in, no? And the next step was they followed up on the no's to tell them why maybe they should go in. And the program went on. And so I think the complications, you know, I'm delighted that seniors have a new sport, you know, figuring out where they should go. You know, keeping them all very, very busy. But I think down the line, this is very worrisome. And I'll say something personal. As a member of Congress for years, I represented Hartford, Connecticut. I understand insurance. And I look, and you know, when I hear WellPoint and I hear Aetna and Cigna, you know, things go on in my head. And when you look at what happened, and why is there so much of this confusion? And I think Senator Baucus sent a letter to the president saying, or whoever he sent the letter, oh, CMS probably. Oh, by the way, I think CMS is wonderful. I will never forgive Tom Scully, never. Absolutely not. But anyway, Senator Baucus said he never thought when he was doing the legislation that anybody who said, oh, I want to provide a prescription drug help or program, that they would just be accepted. There's just too many. And I think what will happen is, as the program goes on, the big companies will make a profit, and slowly but surely will lose those smaller companies. But the big companies, even with the subsidy from the government, those billions of dollars, the big companies are only making about 3 or 4% profit. Now, I just want to say something. We know we have to have the healthier people come in to make this program work, and a lot of them have not signed up because they think they don't have medication. But they eventually will sign up because this, as I said, has become a sport of the seniors. But what is going to happen, and I think all of us should know, Seniors, and I'm one, seniors get older. And as seniors get older, they need more medication. And the profit level will get smaller. And then what happens? And so I say to some of you, don't get totally wrapped up in the little bitty things or the legislative changes that just address a few things. Let some of us continue to say that we should have drug availability for seniors as part of Medicare. And I'm not going to bore you all because you all know about it. Because right now, the government has, you know, people say, oh, we want the government to negotiate like the veterans program. We have no negotiating ability. Everybody's in a private plan. But if we had a piece of Medicare being part of Part D and people wanted to go into that plan, then the government could negotiate for lower prices. So there's a lot to be done. And I just hope we don't all get so involved in the nitty-gritty. We don't look at that. This is one more absolute plan to privatize a government program.
Thank you, Barbara. Leslie.
I'm going to leave the comment about Tom Scully aside.
I've known him for years.
Yeah. But maybe you could reflect a little on what you see are the transitional Absolutely. Issues versus some of the longer-term issues.
I think I'm relieved to know that people here at least have confidence that CMS is working diligently to resolve these problems and appreciate all the comments that folks have made, because we're only going to solve them if we do it together. And that's been our approach thus far. I think the transitional issues will ultimately go away. We'll figure out the computer systems and people will get the drugs they need in the way they're supposed to. Hopefully we can figure out a way that that in working with the pharmacies, one of the things that Debbie mentioned was when you show, if you don't have a card, sort of what happens at the pharmacy and having to call around. And we set up a system, a real-time system, so that pharmacists could determine, even when someone didn't have a card, they could walk into the pharmacy and figure out what plan someone is in, so they don't have to call however many plans there are in that particular state to find out what the individual and where the individual should be getting coverage. And when that works, it works under a second, and that's fantastic. So a lot of that should, even if someone doesn't have a card, we expect that those problems will diminish rapidly, and we've seen that, in fact, already over the past number of weeks. There are a number of things that that Barbara mentioned that I wanted to talk about, and I actually think everyone here at least said one or two things that where we can go back to CMS and provide additional information, whether it's the exceptions process, whether it's the drugs that aren't covered under the Medicare program, where we can provide information to pharmacists and beneficiaries about where that coverage may be, particularly if it's under Medicaid for benzodiazepines and barbiturates, for example. So there are a lot of good ideas here that I'm grateful to bring back and start working on, so we can reduce those particular problems. As for the longer-term issues, I have a slight or perhaps a great difference of opinion from our last speaker, although this is not the first time I've heard these concerns. One of the things that I have found interesting in working in this program, and I too have done a lot of research both in what happened in 1965 as well as what happened in the precursors to the Medicare Modernization Act before 2003. And first of all, from 1965 implementation, we probably have a stack over a foot long of newspaper articles between 1965 and 1966 that read almost identical to the articles we see on the front page of every paper today about the difficulty in implementation, the confusion, and so forth. So I have a slight difference of opinion, not because I was there reading the papers at the time, but that we've done a lot of research and actually dug them up now. And, of course, over time, this became a very beloved program, the Medicare program, and I expect at the end of the day, the drug benefit, too, will become a critical integral part of the Medicare program, particularly as we work through these initial glitches. The last thing that you mentioned, Barbara, was the no negotiation issue. And I think people would be surprised to learn, as I was when I was reading, I was doing some background on pre-MMA work, and on March 3rd, 2000, I read a White House press release that talked about the structure of the Medicare program that President Clinton and Senator Daschle were working on. And one of the key tenets in that program was that private plans would, in fact, be the ones to implement this program, and that the government should be prohibited from interfering with the negotiations. And it's that exact type of language that is existing today in the Medicare Modernization Act. So across the board, Democrats and Republicans at one point in time believed that this was the way to go. And while I appreciate the confidence that everyone has that CMS could accurately price fix or negotiate or whatever it is that people think we do at CMS vis-a-vis payments to providers, I can assure you that we've had our hands full just generally, and I can't imagine the amount of work it would take for us to go through and price thousands and thousands and thousands of drugs. And I'm grateful to have the partnership of the plans and their negotiating power, which far exceeds the numbers of numbers of people covered today that use private insurance and PBMs far exceed the numbers of Medicare beneficiaries. And as I'm sure you'll see in the future, the price of this prescription drug benefit program is doing a lot better than expected, whether it's just the premiums alone and what beneficiaries are being charged this year. We came $5 under. The average premium was initially thought to be by our actuaries, $37 a month. It came in the average at $32, but many, many beneficiaries are paying, under $2 or $10, $15. All have access to plans that are significantly less expensive than that, which is terrific. And because of that alone, the price of this program will be significantly diminished, certainly in this first year, much less than the actuaries had anticipated. In addition, I would point out that a number of other things that she mentioned in terms of the donut hole, for example, Karen also mentioned that there are plans available to all beneficiaries where they can pay a slightly higher premium and not have a coverage gap. It actually depends on the state. It depends on the state and the plan. And for many beneficiaries who have a need for many, many drugs and who find themselves spending over $3,600, this is a terrific option for them to have complete coverage with no deductible and no coverage gap. So coverage from January to December where they're simply paying copayments. So the point of that is that the private market has come to play and has provided everything from inexpensive plans for beneficiaries who need very little as well as more expensive plans that provide more complete coverage. And I think that's a tremendous opportunity for beneficiaries to choose what it is that they need based on their drug needs. So I'll take a breath and drink a water.
And I think Karen would like to offer some comments from a plan perspective.
Thank you, Diane. I think Leslie said it very well. I'd just like to come behind her and give a couple of pieces of information that I think are relevant. On Monday, we're going to be issuing a study that PricewaterhouseCoopers has done for us on cost drivers. They've zeroed in particularly on the effect of plan tools in the pharmaceutical arena, how we've driven down cost, premium costs for working families. We've taken pharmaceutical expenditures from average annual increases of 20% per year over the last several years ago down to around 8 as a modal number and in some cases less. I think that these are exactly the tools that are being leveraged here. I don't know of any other government program, and I guess I must confess I've been around long enough to have looked at a number of them, where the estimates that were issued, we come in better, that is to say, the real costs are less than the estimates. This is the first time that's happened, and I think from a beneficiary perspective, we're hearing from people on fixed incomes who find it particularly valuable that they don't have to pay $38 premiums, they don't have to pay $250 deductibles, they do have more coverage options in terms of cost sharing and so on, and in the donut, and that's particularly valuable. The third thing I'd say is, we've probably had, and I know our plans have had more, but in our shop, we've had discussions with now about roughly half of states about how their costs and their reimbursements to pharmacists exceed plan reimbursements. That's because, again, we've leveraged these tools. That's part of the problem that the states have asked to be made whole because we have contractually been obligated to pay certain amounts of money, and the states find their own rates are much higher in a number of occasions. So I think that this is a demonstration, proof positive, of the ability to leverage tools effectively. But I suspect this won't be the end of the discussion. The town being what it is, I know this will be a very big political year. I'm pleased we have data to contribute to the discussion. Finally, I think Vicki raised a very important point, and it really hadn't occurred to me until you said it the way you did. I've been concerned as an observer looking on the ground at the amount of switching that's going on. States have engaged contractors to work with specific beneficiaries to encourage them to switch. Some of those contractors are not necessarily doing it for the reasons that the state officials would have them do it, and we have to look into that, number one. But I think Vicki's point about having the exceptions process better known, seeing what we can do. What I heard from her message is, can we create some process uniformity among our plans to make that process easier, simpler? And I'm going to go back with that message. I know Leslie's team has been working hard, and I suspect we can collaborate and get that done, because I think that that's a very important point. But I do think as a policy matter, this matter of switching really needs to be looked at, because particularly for dual eligibles, for people with chronic illnesses, comorbidities, you want to make sure they're in a continued care environment where they can be supported. So I think that the issue, Vicki, that you pointed out, I think is a very, very valuable one, and I'm going to take that back.
Just say a word. We're talking about costs, and we all know in marketing, when you're trying to get a customer, the costs are lower. But I don't think we should just talk about costs of this particular program. I can remember when Senator Graham from Florida put in a plan that was part of Medicare, and it was expensive. It was very expensive. I think it was $700 billion that they scored it at. Well, we're about $800 billion for taxpayers on this program. The other point I would like to make is we cannot look at Part D in isolation. As we all know, Part B is becoming a huge problem, and eventually Part B will take almost the whole Social Security check. So when you're talking about somebody on fixed income can pay $69, so the donut hole is covered, we're not talking realistically about what the incomes of seniors are.
Let me ask a question about one group that we haven't really talked about here. We've talked a lot about the dual eligibles, who are the low-income individuals who were on the Medicaid program and getting their drugs through Medicaid prior to the drug legislation. But one of the main features of that legislation was to help people who had low incomes with their subsidies. And the enrollment and participation in the subsidy program is far below the targets. And what is going on there, and how do you think that can be remedied?
I do think that the actuaries estimated 8.4 million would qualify for the limited income subsidy that were non-dually eligible. Thus far, although the last numbers I saw from Social Security, over 4 million had applied, over 1 million had been accepted. That leaves quite a number to go after, and I think it is the hardest population to reach by far, whether it's language difficulties or beyond language, just cultural, actually understanding reading material and so forth. So what we have done is, with all of our regional offices and all of our partners, of which we have 14,000 partners on the ground, to actually focus on where these beneficiaries live. We're working with all sorts of organizations to figure out how can we best reach them. They may not read the mainstream press. They may not look at the media. So we're looking at, or the media generally, so we're looking at where they live, work, play, and pray. And any help that we can get from anyone, anywhere, to reach out to them, explain the process, help them with the application, and have them apply. And then the second step, once they've applied, once they've been accepted, they also need to enroll in a plan if they have not already. And that's the next step that we need to work on with these beneficiaries. But by all means, we always knew that they would be the most difficult to reach and require the most targeting in order to get them the help that they certainly need and we would like them to have. So we've got.
But aren't you also experiencing a high turndown rate among those who apply?
Well, I have, the Social Security Administration is administers that piece of the program in terms of the application in conjunction with the states. So the question is, who is it that's applying? I think a number of people who have been turned down are those who have meet the income test but haven't met the asset test. And you know, we're hopeful that that there can be other step-arounds. One of the groups that you don't have on the panel are the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and they often have provided assistance to these beneficiaries. And hopefully there's a way, even if they don't qualify from an asset test from the Medicare program, that there may be some additional help, whether it's those groups or other advocacy groups that typically provide help to these beneficiaries, that they can get help where they need it.
Diane, the low-income subsidy has actually proven to be very problematic for a number of reasons. We are starting to hear from people now who have been found eligible for a partial subsidy, and they can't afford the copayments. Even 15% is too high for this group. And so they're really actually very disappointed, because they thought they were going to get better protection. We're also hearing from individuals who are having difficulties filling out the application form. I'm one of the people who reviewed the application form, so I can say this. It's very complicated. I had an attorney call me the other day because he had a client who has a resource that, if counted, would make the client ineligible for the benefit. But it's a resource that can't be disposed of within 20 days, and so under the regulations, it shouldn't be counted. But there was no way to accurately reflect that in the application. So that the attorney is going to have to fill out the application saying that there is this resource, be denied, and then file an appeal. And I intend definitely to talk to Social Security about this. But we're finding that the application process is very difficult for people. We're also finding the two-step process is incredibly difficult for people. Individuals who get the low-income subsidy don't understand that they then have to choose a plan. And that's a very hard concept for people. It means you have to go back twice to whoever helped you fill out the application, maybe somebody different from who's going to help you choose a plan. And that's very hard. This is a policy issue that none of us on the panel can do anything about. There shouldn't be an asset test. Kaiser has done some great papers about the number of people who would be eligible for the low-income subsidy if there weren't an asset test, and this needs a legislative fix. It makes the application process too complicated. Social Security could turn this around much more quickly if they didn't have to do the assets as well.
Thank you. And we've had a very patient audience, so now I'd like to open it up for questions from the audience. you could raise your hand, and we'll get a mic to you, and then identify yourself when you ask the question.
Hi, my name's Matt Tobias. I'm with Modern Healthcare. And Leslie, I think Senate Finance was scheduled to meet yesterday with Secretary Leavitt and Mark McClellan. And I think one of the discussion topics was an extension of the enrollment period. Could you give us an update on if that is going to happen, and if not, why not?
I wasn't at the meeting, although I wouldn't be surprised if that particular topic came up. It would require a legislative change. Currently, it's January. I think it's a bit premature to say, oh, we need to extend that particular date. We're all human beings. I would be willing to bet that every one of us at some point in time has procrastinated and put something off to the last minute. It's not unlike what we saw at the end of December, where we had fairly large numbers of enrollments. If you give people more time and they put something off, they'll continue to put it off. Certainly, if we can, as the Secretary says when he's on the road, it would be a shame if people didn't sign up because they never heard of it, which is very different from people not signing up even though they knew about it and had made a conscious decision to say, hey, this isn't for me. So at this point in time, I think it's premature for us to say we should extend that particular date, and our position is let's wait and see.
Hi, Andrea Maresco with the National Association of Community Health Centers. Thank you all for your comments and the many concerns that were raised. As you can imagine, we have a population that includes a lot of dually eligible beneficiaries. And the question I have, Julie, you mentioned the patient assistance programs. I think that's what you were referring to. And had heard that there was going to be additional guidance because our patients and staff are concerned about the decisions that are taking place currently to discontinue the programs, or what the decisions that people have to make in terms of enrolling either in a Part D program or in a PAP program. So can you shed any light on that? And the second concern, and Karen, you might be more appropriate to answer this, is for individuals who are LEP, limited English proficiency, and speak other languages other than Spanish is often a common language that things are translated into. Excuse me. But also we have a lot of patients who speak Vietnamese or Mandarin. Is there a way to connect people with interpreters through the plans who are calling for more information?
With regard to patient assistance programs, it should be on our website by now. We just put up the CMS perspective on patient assistance programs. I think the top line point is that there is nothing in anything that HHS does, whether it's the OIG or CMS, that prohibits patient assistance programs. There are certainly from an OIG perspective, although I promise you I do not speak for them, but from the overall department perspective, there are some hoops that people need to go through, but there is no reason why they can't work together. And whether it be inside the benefit, through other foundations, for example, that that wouldn't come afoul of fraud and abuse laws, or even outside of the benefit, much like it worked before January 1st, where beneficiaries could receive prescription drugs. They just can't bill the federal government for those drugs, which means no deductible, no co-payments, no co-insurance, and so forth. But the patient assistance program itself could still provide that drug to the beneficiary. So the guidance lays out some of those points, gives an example, and we also, I think the point is that we want to work with pharmaceutical manufacturers who are interested in continuing these, whether it's helping them with talk to the OIG or the Federal Trade Commission if they're doing something more broadly together as manufacturers as a whole, or if they want to do it outside of the Part D benefit. One of the things that the Office of the Inspector General Advisory Bulletin does is require some data matching agreements with CMS, and so working on that particular piece so that we can make the process go as smoothly as possible. We know how much patients rely on these particular programs and would like to help help them continue going forward. And given that there's nothing currently under federal law that would prohibit them, generally they may need to be slightly restructured, and I don't want to say that it that doesn't take some work. I think that it does, but I think that work is worthwhile. I know that you asked Karen the LEP concerns. I'd just like to say that at 1-800-MEDICARE, we do have 100 different languages available. I guess the key thing is to figure out how to tell the operator that you need to talk to someone in another language. I'm not exactly sure how that works, to be honest, but we do have translation lines far broader than just Spanish. And Karen, I don't know if you've got other.
Yes, and we do as well. I was going to mention, until Leslie did, the 1-800-MEDICARE is very well staffed in a whole range of languages. I was just out in L.A. visiting one of our small plans that has capacity for 18 languages. So it gives you a sense that that all 18 individuals may not be on the customer service line at the same time. So I think the best way to do that is to have someone who speaks English or Spanish at, make the initial call to ask that particular plan that an individual may be interested in, their language capacity, particularly for the language that that individual is concerned about. That would be the quickest way to get through all of this and then to get hooked up with the right person that could answer the questions.
Marty from the Republican in Springfield, Mass. I have quick questions. Leslie, you want to switch seniors from fee-for-service into managed care. The question is, can you actually manage care old people in health care? Karen, my pharmacist told me that the generic drugs prices have been tripling. Barbara, Congresswoman, what's wrong with privatizing health care for seniors?
First off, I'd point out that that at some point in time, all of us in this room, God willing, will all be in the Medicare program. And many of us today, I would say, of the in the under 65 market, 95% of all people under 65 who are insured have some sort of managed care program. 50% are in preferred provider organizations. Another 25% are in HMOs with a point of service option where they can go out of their network and see whatever individual they need. And another 20% are in a closed panel HMO. Those numbers may have changed. Sort of, those are a couple years old. But the point is only 5% of the under 65 market are in a fee-for-service program. As we all age into the program, and as I said, I hope we all do, that many of us will be able to, will have been experiencing managed care, comfortable with the concepts, at least understanding them, and so forth. And I do think that is appropriate for the Medicare population to have the same types of options that are available in the under 65 market. And in particular, one of the things that the Medicare Modernization Act does is focus on preferred provider organizations. We have them available in
a majority of states now, so that people who do want to have the ability to see any provider but are willing to pay, get the benefit of paying less for providers in the network and but are willing to pay more if they want to see a particular provider, still having overall savings, perhaps getting additional benefits like vision benefits and dental benefits. We think that's an important option for beneficiaries to have. It is an option. It will continue to be an option. The actuaries estimate that over time, the fee-for-service population would remain stable and those in managed care would grow. So as the Medicare population grows, that growth change would more or less go to varying managed care options. So
I'd like to answer on that visit to Bob Ball. And like Leslie, I've looked at the history of what happened during the 65. And I said, why do the insurance companies fight Medicare? Because obviously before Medicare, they didn't want to insure the older people. They didn't have insurance. And he said, because they didn't want to have the government get into insurance. Well, now we've come full circle. But I'd just like to mention that if you're over 65, you're the only one that has a universal health care. If you're under 65, you're in the private market. And I believe there's about 45 million people that aren't insured. So I don't understand why we want to take apart something that's working to put into something that isn't working. And I think that's what privatization would do.
I want you to swear that I did not put you up to your first question about managing folks or doing coordinated care in Medicare. The fact is, no, I understand you asked me the genetic, yes, but I also want to take a crack at the first point you made, because the data from CMS show that we're doing a much better job managing and doing coordinated care on beneficiaries with comorbidities. And that's why CMS is trying to introduce the same tools, care coordination, disease management, into the traditional fee-for-service that we've pioneered on the managed care side. On to your other point, I think it's very important that you made it. There's been too much focus in the policy community on simply the trajectory of pricing on the manufacturing side. We need to look at, and so it's simply been the focus, the contrast in pricing between the generics and the manufacturers. Now that more people are moving into the generic side, we absolutely have to look at the trajectory of pricing, and you're completely right about that. So I hope that from this important discussion, there'll be much more focus on that. You're right, and we should pay attention to it.
I'd like to just pick up on the practicalities of why sometimes managed care can be very difficult for this population. When I have to drive cross town to go to a doctor who's a preferred provider for my PPO, I can drive cross town and I can drive the 10 miles downtown to go see the ophthalmologist. My father, who's in Medicare fee-for-service, must rely on the transportation provided by the senior community in which he lives, because you don't want him driving. And that senior community will only drive him within a 5-mile radius. That means that he is restricted to seeing doctors within that 5-mile radius. If he were in a PPO and the preferred doctor was 10 miles away, he couldn't get to that doctor. And it wouldn't be a choice of his to use a non-network doctor. He would be forced to use a non-network doctor. He would have expenses that exceed his current expenses under fee-for-service Medicare and the supplement he has through his retiree health plan. So we need to look at some of the practicalities first.
Thanks. This is a question for Leslie. I'm Marcia Gold from Mathematica Policy Research. I wanted to shift it a little and talk about MA, and I was hoping that you could help us understand the enrollment numbers that CMS put out on MA better as it relates to people in prescription drug plans. The latest data before this, I think, showed that there were 6.1 million people in MA plans generally, not MA, in any kind of private plan, including demos and things, in November of 2005. So, and there are 4.5 without duals who have drug coverage now in January. So what I'm trying to figure out is, of that 4.5, how many are new and how many are existing? And of the people who were already enrolled in managed care plans in 2005, of which there were around 6 million, how do you get to the ones who you're counting as having drug coverage in January? Did they actively enroll? Were they passively enrolled? Which plan did they get in? which did it take? And if you can help us figure that out, we can better understand how that relates to historical numbers.
Peter, do you have the number of the new additions to Medicare Advantage? Get with you. We'll have to get back to you on the new. I'm looking at the press release that we sent out. It doesn't like pop out at me, but I'll get you back. Get back to the number. It's a few hundred thousand is my recollection of the new enrollees into Medicare Advantage with prescription drugs this year. In terms of the process, those who were in a Medicare Advantage program that had some drug coverage in 2005, they were rolled over to the same Medicare Advantage plan with drug coverage. So that's. I think that's correct, yes. I'm sure that's correct, actually. So that's sort of the first point. There are other types of Medicare Advantage that didn't have drug coverage beforehand. And my recollection is we did not, Karen, you might be able to confirm this, didn't passively enroll those individuals. So cost plans, for example, demonstration plans that didn't have drug benefits and so forth. So those individuals had the option to choose a Medicare Advantage program. I think that's part of the difference with the numbers. But if you give me your card, I'll be sure to get you the specifics, and maybe we can do a fact sheet for the industry at large on Medicare Advantage and how those enrollment numbers work. All right. Sure.
Hi, my name is Kathy Halverson, and I'm a volunteer with the DC SHIP. And I've been a very big admirer of CMS over the last couple of years. I thought they did some wonderful thinking about this program, the troop facilitator and the WellPoint point of service in particular. But, you know, there have been huge problems. And I know that you've discussed these systems issues. And I know that it sounds like you're going to fix them, but could you talk about them a little bit more, because we're spending a lot of time fantasizing about all of the things that are going wrong right now. Thank you.
So your question is to talk about some of the fixes in terms of what were both the problems and the fixes. As a preliminary, one of the, I think, figuring out what the issues are, the first and probably the biggest problem we saw, and I'll point out one of the things that's been very interesting in all of this is that the issues that we're seeing is they are not uniform across the states. That we are hearing, I heard a governor a couple weeks ago come in and say, geez, I read this article in the New York Times and we don't understand, we're not having any problems in our state or very few problems in our state, certainly none of the type that were described here. In another state, they said, well, we have 50,000 duals and we switched 10,000 of them, and that's really where all of our problems are coming up, are in these 10,000. I have another state that said we're having problems across the board with all of our duals. So the first thing that we need to do is determine from a diagnostic perspective what the problem is. Are the problems different? And in some cases, I think the answer to that question is yes. And where do they occur? So that's the primary and first objective, is to figure out problems, particularly where they're systemic. Secondly, in addition to working with the states, obviously we're spending lots of time with the plans. What happens with enrollment and limited income subsidy information, we get it from many sources. You get it from the Social Security Administration. You get it from the states. You get it from the Railroad Retirement Board. The plans also have input, and CMS has input. That's five at least, and the beneficiary at some point, or the pharmacy, also has an interaction here. So that's at least five, probably six different places where information can go wrong. And it's these are all varying computer systems. So while we have something set up for the pharmacy so that the pharmacy can determine what plan a beneficiary is eligible in with, or particularly when the beneficiary doesn't have a card, we are working diligently with the contractor who's provided this information, but that's all the information is, basically, is what plan is this person in. That particular system does not provide information about the plan, coinsurance, copayments, and so forth, although we've been looking at whether or not something like that is possible. Right now, the answer is it's not possible in the short term. The next piece is what do we do to make life easier for a pharmacist? Because at the end of the day, as Debbie pointed out, it's where the rubber meets the road. If you can't get your drug at a pharmacist, you're in big trouble. So a significant amount of support for the pharmacist, separate and apart from the eligibility query that we've set up. You mentioned the WellPoint point of service option. For beneficiaries who do not have a plan, show up at a pharmacy, nothing comes back in the eligibility query, they don't have a card, they don't have a letter, those beneficiaries can be put into a point of service option where the beneficiary can get at least a 2-week supply of prescriptions, and at the back end, The insurance company, WellPoint, will reconcile with whatever insurance company or Part D plan the beneficiary should have been in, and if not, then WellPoint would take that particular enrollment. So that for dual eligibles in particular, that's been a very important piece of the pie. One of the things we've tried to do is make it easier and easier for pharmacists by reducing the number of steps they have to take. We want them to spend time with the patient talking about the prescriptions that that patient needs, not having to do this administrative hassle. We've also set up a special toll-free number for pharmacists who can get immediate access. We hope I'm going to have found wait times under a few minutes to Medicare customer service representatives. Similarly, we've been working with the plans, particularly those who have high volumes of dual eligibles, to provide special toll-free numbers so that they can get through to the plans more quickly and the plans can provide the correct copayment information, in particular when you're talking about a limited income subsidy person. Now, so those are some of the basic things in terms of fixes. Behind the scenes, we've done everything from create SWAT teams to work with the plans and the states to ensure that the information flow is accurate, determine where there may be an issue, and I can assure you there can be issues any number of ways. One of the things we've seen is that the Social Security Administration, for example, may have a different birth date than the beneficiary. That's a critical way for a pharmacist to find out what plan someone is in using the eligibility query. So how is it that we can reconcile differences of information that may be just a part of the system, and who knows, you know, why that particular thing would have happened? Finally, we have casework so that when a beneficiary goes to the counter and for whatever reason can't get what they need or only gets a short supply because the pharmacist appreciates that this is a critical need, we have caseworkers both within our regional offices through 1-800-MEDICARE, and also working with the plans to make sure that we can, behind the scenes, particularly in urgent cases, get people the scripts that they need on the day that they need them. So I think we're doing all sorts of things, appreciating that the transition from a computer perspective is going to take a little more time to work out than we would like. I mean, we'd like it to be perfect today, certainly. I think, done lots of things to try and make it as easy as possible for beneficiaries to get what they need without totally overburdening a pharmacy who is already, because it's January, seeing lots of changes. Many of us probably changed health plans, may not have our cards, and there is no eligibility system for people at large. So a poor pharmacist may be calling not just on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries, but on behalf of the general population, anyone who's switched their insurance company in January. So we do want to make it as easy as possible and appreciate Debbie and her colleagues, all the pharmacists who are doing yeoman's work and are really heroes to make this work. And I can promise you behind the scenes, there is nothing we'd like more than to solve each and every one of these problems, because until we do, we know how much casework we all are going to be doing. And certainly those of you at the ships who are also on the front lines, if you see trends or anything systemic, we're very interested in that information, and whether you're working with our regional offices or us at central office, and you are seeing trends, both good and bad, they're both helpful from a diagnostic perspective, and invite, in fact, anyone here who's seeing a trend to let us know what you're seeing, and we hope that it's people are getting the drugs they need at the end of the day.
I'm Mary Agnes Carey with Congressional Quarterly. I think it was raised earlier, the concern about pharmacists trying to figure out if a drug is just not on a formulary or not covered under Part D, and I think the reference was to anxiety drugs. And I'm a little confused about this because the way that I understood the plan was all sorts of drugs from all classes will be covered. And another speaker talked about the difficulty in appealing this to some of the plans. So what's going on with this class of drugs, and why is there a problem? Thank you.
The two specific classes of drugs that the statute prohibits are benzodiazepines and barbiturates. So those particular drugs, I think in every state but one, are covered through the Medicaid program for those who are duly eligible. And those states, by the way, would get federal matching if they continued to, and they would continue to cover them under the state program. There are six classes of drugs that this year the Medicare program required all plans to cover. Let's see if I can remember them all. There are antineoplastics, which are cancer drugs, seizure medications, medications for after transplants, antipsychotics, antidepressants, and drugs for HIV/AIDS. Antiretroviral. So for those six classes of drugs, we've required all or substantially all of those drugs to be covered. I think with there may be one or two exceptions, but basically all drugs in those classes are. The other thing that we did was require, actually the statute requires this, that all medically necessary drugs, with the couple of exceptions I mentioned before and a few others, things like over-the-counter drugs, cough and cold medication, et cetera, you need to cover at least two of those drugs in every class. The classes were defined by the U.S. Pharmacopeia, and we went through every single formulary to approve it for that purpose. What we're seeing more generally are a couple things. I've heard two different problems. One is, what happens when a drug was covered or is covered under Medicare Part B, typically, you know, the physician benefit, and compared to Medicare Part D? And there is some difficulty there, because some drugs are covered in both. It depends on the circumstances of the beneficiary. So we've been working on a solution so that plans understand in what circumstances, so plans and pharmacists and beneficiaries can all understand when something should be covered under Medicare Part B with a 20% coinsurance payment versus the prescription drug plan. Anyone who was, as a general rule, when it was covered under Part B before, it remains covered under Part B. And drugs that were not under our Part D, but it's not quite that that elegant a solution. We do have some information on our website that talks about the difference, and that might help you understand that. The second category that that I've seen problems are what is cold and cough medication, something else that is excluded, and how is it that the plans are administering that? And that's something that I heard recently. And we're going to go back and take a look to be sure that those medications that should be covered in some way are covered under the plans, and at least, again, two in every class would meet the requirements. So you don't have to cover all the drugs, but you would have to cover two of them. And to figure out why we're hearing about those particular instances, those are probably the two most common things that I hear, or I've heard at least this week on that issue.
One question in the back.
I'd like to keep it current.
Hi, my name is Leslie Freed, and I have a question about a problem we're expecting in February, which has to do with many people did finally get some of their drugs under the transition plans. My understanding is people were supposed to get a letter from the plan saying you got a one-time fill, you're supposed to be doing something, either go to your doctor, get a different drug, or file an exception. We're not hearing of people getting those letters. So our concern is that people will go back to their pharmacy when their 30-day prescription runs out, try to get a drug, and be told, no, you can't get it, you got your one-time fill, and that's it. Yet, since they didn't get the letter, they didn't understand that there had to be next steps followed. So that's my first question. And my second question has to do with, really, if we hadn't done the random assignment of the duals, would we not see so many people having to change plans now because they were enrolled randomly in plans where their drugs were not covered?
Can I just say something interesting on that last point? We're finding that many people who, quote unquote, switched plans, switched into the plan they're already in. So I'm not sure in terms of these of the switching, and it's actually I don't remember the specific number, but I remember being surprised at how many people where that actually happened. I think I would go back to my original point that all of the plans are required to cover all medically necessary treatments except for the statutorily excluded drugs. And for those six classes of drugs that I mentioned before, where typically you have a you need to take the particular drug that you're taking and they are not interchangeable, and you have a particular drug regimen. And we have, because of those two things together and the exceptions policy that Vicki mentioned earlier, we really think that all of the switching that's occurred is probably not necessary because there are broad treatments in all of the plans. I appreciate that some beneficiaries feel very particular about whatever drug it is they're taking, and so they can switch, frankly, every month. The random assignment is something that the statute required, so it's not as if we had a policy choice there to do that. But I do think that beneficiaries are protected by a number of things, all of which I've mentioned. So that's that. In terms of the transition issues and letters, I think it would be helpful for us to have a better understanding of which specific plans those are, and we'll
go back and do some research. I don't know, Karen, if you've got some thoughts.
Yeah, I have thoughts on two matters. The first of all, the switching. We are finding exactly what Leslie suggested. And Kathy, we'd be delighted to take you through this kinds of systems issues. And I've been very pleased that CMS has really segmented the problems. One of the most important things that we uncovered, and CMS is hard at work, is this. The E1 screen that the pharmacists have, the phone numbers that were pulled by the contractor, not by CMS employees, but by the contractor that was used, were not the correct phone numbers. So from the get-go, the pharmacist didn't have the right numbers. CMS is really doing a yeoman's job of focusing on this, working with the pharmacy groups, getting that information out, and I think that they really deserve a great deal of credit for that. There are issues with respect to, and this gets to switching, getting the time from the time we send information to CMS and get it back. Again, CMS has put a top-level team, SWAT team, on resolving that issue. Then we get to the duals issues, and a number of our plans have people switching back into the same plan, as Leslie said. So now that we're getting data from the system, we can track those sorts of things. But I do think that for a number of the advocates in this audience, there really needs to be a look at some of the companies that are engaged in the switching process on behalf of a variety of folks. How are they funded? What's their motivation, et cetera? Because I'm not sure it's the same motivation that the advocates have. Number one, on the plans, if you have specific examples, I would love to hear them because that would be a great way. We're trying to be a bridge between the advocacy community and the health plans. I want to make sure that the processes are working exactly as they should, and I'd be delighted to work with you if you have some specific cases, because that's a great way to just track, and this is exactly what we're doing in the systems steps, to at a micro level track where the breakdowns are, what's happening, and it's helped us really provide the kind of information that CMS has needed, and I would be delighted to do the same with you. Our plans are committed to sending messages and to provide the education that people need. There is an issue of 4 million people coming into this program in addition to the 20 in 3 weeks. So if I would be able to find out if letters are backed up or what the issues are and give you a better comfort that people have things under control. So I'd be delighted to work with you to do that.
May I just add one point regarding that transitional issue, that transitional supply? For those of you that are advocates in the room, maybe encourage these folks to come back to their pharmacies for refills when they still have about 3 to 5 days left of their medication, and not waiting until they're totally out of the medication so the pharmacist can do something for you, help you out, and work with the other folks involved in the process you've heard about to get them their medication to move forward.
Except that the exceptions process and the appeals process is a systemic issue. The way it was developed both by Congress and implemented by CMS, it's very user unfriendly. And when you think that this is a population that's very diverse, and you do have people who are frail with mental incapacities, with physical incapacities, it's not a system that's going to work well for them. So this is an issue that we're going to see. This is a future issue that's going to exist with this program.
Judy Cahill with the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy. Leslie, would like to add my thanks to CMS for all of the hours and the ongoing work that you're doing. My question is looking a little bit farther down the road. We know that people move on and off the state eligibility requirements for Medicaid, and I'm curious about how CMS anticipates handling updates in status as this occurs amongst dual eligibles. Who will receive notification of that? What's the anticipated turnaround time for that type of change? Because as we all know, it affects the benefit level.
Well, it's my understanding that the Medicare program and the limited income subsidy piece is an annual process. So even if you're on the rolls and you qualify and you later come off the rolls, even within the same year, you maintain your dual eligible status for Part D purposes. And then on an annual basis, that would be updated. So if you weren't eligible at the end of the year, then it would be annual. If you became eligible during the year, of course, then you would be, let's say you were off the rolls in November, came back on in March, you'd be covered from March to the end of the following year.
But this is a very big problem for a number of individuals, because we're going to find people who are they are no longer eligible for Medicaid because they don't have drug expenses. They are not going to be recertified for the low-income subsidy. They're not going to be able to afford their drug benefits. They will go without drug benefits, or then they will become eligible for Medicaid again. They will be paying penalties because they disenrolled from their drug plan. The other unintended consequence of this program is that there are a number of duals who do become eligible for Medicaid because of their drug costs. They won't be able to use these drug costs to continue their Medicaid eligibility, so they are, in essence, going to lose health care that they have now.
Well, I think we have raised a lot of issues. I've seen a lot of note-taking at the table, which I think is a sign that some of these issues are going to get put high on the agenda when people go back to their offices. I think you have all been a great audience in terms of giving us more ideas, and so I want to thank the audience and the panelists for a great discussion, and let's keep working on getting this benefit right.